an inmate at Central Prison. This call will be monitored and recorded. For customer assistance, collection, or complaint procedures, or to block future calls, dial 1-866-230-7761. To accept this call, press 5 now. To decline this call, hang up. Thank you for using Global Pill Link.
Hello.
Hi, Lyle. How are you?
Hey, how's it going?
It's going fine so far. How's things there?
Okay. You know, kind of a slow afternoon, usually the case. Kind of warm in here. Can't exactly open a window and they got the heat on. So,
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling. We have Scott. I think if you can tell him that he did a fantastic job, I think that would be appropriate. He gave a really nice talk, and I think the students were really affected by that. So we're ready to hear from you
okay.
this time.
I'll certainly let him know. So one of the things I would like for you to think about before I go into my formal comments is that when somebody is charged with murder, and you're in North Carolina and it's a first-degree murder, one of the first things that happens after the grand jury indictment comes down is that the prosecution, if it decides to go for the death penalty, has what's called a Rule 24 hearing. And at this Rule 24 hearing, you know, the prosecution will present evidence that shows particular aggravating circumstances. And one of those aggravating circumstances is called what's called especially crime was especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel. Well, an element of heinous, atrocious, and cruel, two elements actually, are the amount of time between the threat of death and the actual murder, and then the amount of psychological torture that's experienced by the victim. So I want you to think about that. When a friend or family member dies, the pain never goes away, but it may dull with time. When that death is a tragic murder, processing grief can be especially difficult. Imagine if you lost a whole group of friends and had to suppress grief because the same thing that killed them could very well kill you. Each loss compounds the next, and despair eats at your resolve. Keep adding people you know, one every week. Imagine watching them pack up their belongings and be escorted away by a squad of executioners. You know how your friends will suffer and die, but even as you empathize with them, it's twisted with a twinge of self-preservation. At least it's not your turn. Not yet. This is what it means to live under the threat of state-sanctioned murder. The method, gas, firing squad, lethal injection, electric chair, or hanging, is relative to the amount of suffering and anticipatory terror of how you'll be executed. Every execution has an additive psychological impact, even those in other states. Try to block it out, but someone is always talking about it, or in the quiet, unbidden moments, you remember a face or a snatch of conversation. Sometimes you think of your friend's final words or last gasping, jerking moments on the gurney. The truth is, there is no blocking it out, because as long as you remain on death row, it could be you. I've lived through 33 executions. It took years before I realized blocking out these deaths did more harm than good. I've witnessed many of my peers ignore execution and self-medicate. Many of them now display symptoms of anxiety, depression, or some form of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Roughly half of everyone on North Carolina's death row is prescribed a psychotropic medication. Some experience severe psychosis, manic depression, dissociative disorders, or schizophrenia. Those who remain lucid understand prolonged confinement on death row triggers these mental illnesses in our peers. We see them deteriorate day by day. Because North Carolina's death row is congregate confinement instead of solitary, one might argue death row phenomenon is absent, except there isn't firm agreement on what the definition of death row phenomenon is. Prison conditions on death row vary, as much as people vary in their ability to resist. It also matters whether a state has an active execution chamber or not. So North Carolina hasn't executed anyone since 2006. Most of us on death row were around when the state killed 4 to 6 people each year. Death row confinement was different back then. The threat was constant, consistent, and reinforced through many subtle cues prior to, during, and after an execution. a flurry of final visits for the condemned, their social withdrawal, and eventual removal by the death squad, media coverage of the execution, heightened security, and even an executioner's meal, where guards celebrate the condemned's execution. And then finally, an ambulance carrying away the deceased. These and other reminders are impossible to ignore. Like Pavlov's dogs, eventually, it doesn't even take meat powder or a bell. The fear of execution can be triggered by a lost appeal or someone saying, I've got a date. Under such circumstances, hearing people having people talk to doesn't even really matter. Fear becomes a collective experience. The span of time since the last execution has allowed for increased intimacy between friends. That closeness makes the threat of execution harder to bear because of greater familiarity with everyone on the unit. In this sense, even natural deaths become difficult. Life under sentence of death is torture. It's why the European Court of Human Rights in Soaring v. United Kingdom in 1989 refused to extradite a prisoner to stand trial in America. The court held he would suffer prolonged confinement under harsh conditions on death row, which would result in psychological trauma. This is known as death row phenomenon. The academic David Sadoff focused on the psychological trauma element, which has the distinctive term of death row syndrome. But Sadoff, who borrows from Dr. Stuart Grassian's studies on solitary confinement, refers to solitary confinement death rows, the primary form of incarceration under a sentence of death in the United States. In the U.S., use of death row syndrome in post-conviction capital appeals has failed to garner relief. The courts view the term as a prisoner's attempt to be declared incompetent and avoid execution. There has been only one exception. Federal District Court Judge Cormac Carney held death row phenomenon as a real thing and attempted to declare California's death penalty unconstitutional. But the decision was ultimately reversed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Otherwise, American courts refuse to acknowledge death row syndrome or phenomenon, nor will they accept international standards of torture. Doing so would mean capital punishment is unconstitutional, no matter how a person is confined. Instead, the courts use the standard of cruel and unusual punishment, which has nothing to do with the death penalty per se, because the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments allow for capital punishment. Long-term solitary confinement has also been upheld by various courts as constitutional, if it serves a legitimate penological interest. Therein lies the Eighth Amendment loophole, through which states and the federal government get away with torturing people sentenced to death. In the 15 years since North Carolina's last execution, little has changed. The possibility of execution is a persistent, albeit distant, threat, juxtaposed with the fear of death by incarceration. Mental and physical health care is inadequate. Fear of receiving a sentence reduced to life imprisonment without parole after serving decades on death row is constant. Life without parole makes people on death row despair almost as much, if not more, than being executed. Because if you have a legitimate innocence claim or legitimate reason to believe that you should not have been convicted of first-degree murder, once you're sentenced to life without parole, you'll lose legal representation. And that will mean permanent, unpaid, forced labor, coupled with degrading treatment in a violent environment until you grow old, infirm, and die. I can't stress how demeaning it is to be treated like property, a thing that has little value. The people who support life without parole sentences to replace capital punishment have never spent a day in prison, disconnected from family, devoid of value, and cast off by society without the benefit of chance at redemption. If they had, they too might prefer death. The U.S. has sentenced over 56,000 people to life without parole for violent and nonviolent crimes alike. When parole-eligible life sentences and virtual life sentences of 50 years or more are included, over 208,000 men, women, and adolescents have been sentenced to die in prison for everything from property and drug offenses to murder. This is more than 2.5 times the United Kingdom's entire prison population and more life sentence prisoners than any country in the world. The reluctance to accept life without parole while sentenced to death has a lot to do with giving up legal representation and the ability to appeal a court's decision. As Scott talked with you Monday, that appellate process is very convoluted and impossible and unlikely to navigate on your own. Non-capital defendants in the U.S. lack post-conviction appellate counsel. This makes pursuing innocence claims and sentence reductions because one was overcharged incredibly difficult. As a result, some people would prefer to stay on death row to keep their legal representation or drop their appeals and be executed instead of eking out an existence in prison. But when those options are removed from you, as some attorneys try to do and a non-executing state effectively does, you're stuck on death row suffering. Life without parole is a relatively new fear in Americans' penal history. At the turn of the 20th century and up until the 1960s, death sentences were frequently commuted by the governor in an act of clemency. That alternative sentence was usually a number term, not life imprisonment. Life without parole is a product of the 1980s and 1990s tough on crime era, just like clemency and parole were casualties of it. This lack of mercy is paired with a complete lack of common sense or accuracy. Since 1977, it's important to know that North Carolina has reversed death sentences on appeal approximately 71 to 74% of the time. That includes 8 exonerations. This figure, from a relatively small pool of cases in one state, begs important questions. If life without parole cases receive the same level of scrutiny and legal representation as capital cases, what would the reversal rate be? How many people would be exonerated? The permanency of life imprisonment should merit greater legal protections for the defendant, but in many ways the opposite is true. Some people are tricked into pleading guilty and accepting life without parole to avoid a death sentence, wrongly believing they're getting a bargain. So before I started talking, I asked you to consider these aggravating circumstances, what it means to apply heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and how if a person has been charged with murder, a prosecutor can seek the death penalty if the time between the threat of death and the commission of that murder is particularly lengthy, or that also includes a form of psychological torture. Well, this really begs the question because those are the elements that are present in a death sentence. In serving time on death row over a long period of time, there's a particular case that was brought up in Texas in the mid-90s by the name of Lackey, in which the defendant argued that his uncertain delay between his conviction and sentence and the time that he was supposed to be done with his appeals and executed made it a particular form of torture. Well, the court ignored his claim, or at least, you know, overruled it and said that, you know, he didn't have a right to due process in this sense. And there have been other cases like Jones versus Chappelle, which is the case that Judge Cormac Carney heard, in which the delay between of confinement on death row was brought up as Eighth Amendment claim. But again, the courts have overruled these particular circumstances. And it begins to make you wonder if it is allowed as an aggravating circumstance to charge somebody with capital murder, but it is ignored in terms of a finding of cruel and unusual punishment when applied to someone who has been convicted of murder. Does this mean that the person who has been convicted of a crime is any less a human being and any more deserving of that protection? And that's kind of a question I would like you to consider today after I get off and you continue the discussion.
Remaining.
Thank you for that, Lyle. Is there anything else you want to add? I know that our students are just listening, letting it sink in. And thanks for mentioning all those court cases, because they're the ones that the students have already been studying.
Well, then that's excellent. You know, certainly consider this question, because this is an argument I'm proposing as kind of a loophole in the Eighth Amendment that certainly the courts have
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Should definitely
Yeah, we'll look that up and I'll make it available. Thanks for calling, Lyle.
No problem. You take it easy.
All right, thank you.